This is Wendy Bauer, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated February 1st, 2016. We continue now with the death notices on page A6. First, the deaths listed in Macon County. We have Marion V. Dickinson of Decatur, Madonna D. Dilbeck of Decatur, Jane Evelyn Evie Hicks of Forsyth, Dean Holcomb of Decatur, Glenda L. Houghton of Decatur, Doris May Howard of Argenta, Darlene Johnson, Decatur, Theodore Spence, Decatur, Wendell Winings of Decatur. Additional Central Illinois deaths listed: William E. Fisher from Assumption, Robert Eugene Cowan of Sullivan, Shirley R. Leica of Iliopolis, Donald Marshall of Sullivan, Jerry Dean Middleton, Yale, Roger D. Miller of Clinton, Kathleen Nichols of Newton, Ralph W. Robeson of Brownstone, and Helen Strange of Clinton. The obituaries include Dean Holcomb, 87, of Decatur, who passed away at 3:03 p.m. Friday, January 29, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. A service to celebrate Dean's life will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, February 4, 2016, at Pilgrim Lutheran Church, with Pastor William Abbott and Pastor Brock Abbott officiating. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation beginning at 10 o'clock a.m. Thursday until service time at the church. Memorials may be made to the Humane Society of Decatur and Macon County or the Wounded Warrior Project. Madonna T. Althoff Dilbeck, 91, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away peacefully at 11:18 p.m. on Saturday, January 30th, 2016, at the Fair Havens Christian Home, Decatur, Illinois. Private family mass celebrating her life will be held at St. James Catholic Church at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016. Memorial contributions may be sent to the family. From Sullivan, Robert Eugene Popeye Cowan, 86, of Sullivan, passed away at 3:56 a.m. Saturday, January 30th, 2016, at St. Mary's Hospital, Decatur. Funeral services will be held at 2 o'clock p.m. Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016, at McMullen Young Funeral Home in Sullivan. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be in Green Hill Cemetery, Sullivan, with military rites by the Sullivan American Legion Post No. 68. Memorials may be made to the Sullivan American Legion Post No. 68. From Decatur, Wendell Winings, 85, of Decatur, went to be with his Lord and Savior at 3:50 p.m. Friday, January 29, 2016. Services to celebrate his life will be held at a later date. From Sullivan, Donald Carroll Marshall, 84, of Sullivan, passed away at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, January 30, 2016, at Mason Point, Sullivan. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. Wednesday, February 3, 2016, at McMullen Young Funeral Home, Sullivan. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. at the funeral home in Sullivan. Burial will be in Green Hill Cemetery, Sullivan, with military rites by the Sullivan American Legion Post No. 68. Memorials may be made to the Make-A-Wish Foundation or the Mason Point Activity Department. From Iliopolis, Shirley R. Leica, 73 of Iliopolis passed peacefully on Friday, January 29th, 2016, at St. John's Hospital. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016, at Fullenweider Park Funeral Home in Mechanicsburg. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016, at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Mechanicsburg Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the American Heart Association or the ALS Association and will be accepted at the funeral home. Fullenweider Park Funeral Home, 200 South Church Street in Mechanicsburg, 62545, is in charge of arrangements. And a listing of funerals today, Monday, February 1st, include Jane Evelyn Evie Hicks, 76, from Forsyth, at 11 a.m. in St. John's Episcopal Church. William E. Fisher, 85, of Assumption, at 11 a.m. in Sites Funeral Home, Assumption. Doris May Howard, 91, of Argenta, at 11 a.m. in Calvert Funeral Home, Argenta. Darlene Johnson, 80, of Decatur, at 11:30 a.m. in Tabernacle Baptist Church. Jerry Dean Middleton, 74, of Yale, formerly of Robinson, at 1 p.m. in New Hope Cumberland Presbyterian Church in Yale. Roger D. Miller, 82, of Clinton, at 11 a.m. in Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton. And Ralph W. Robeson, 95, of Brownstone, at 11 a.m. in Liberty Christian Church, Brownstone. And now, from the Books and Literature page, an article written by Donette Becker, a Herald and Review staff writer. Clinton native returns to her roots in Shrink-Wrapped. As a child, author Belinda Hubert was always looking for a way out of her small Midwestern town. Having spent most of her childhood in Clinton, she took any opportunity given to her to leave the area. Her first journey outside of the United States was an exchange student to Medellin, Colombia in high school. She has since traveled throughout the world. But it is the middle of Illinois that became the setting for Hubert's novel, the romantic thriller Shrink-Wrapped. Within the first chapter, central Illinois towns and businesses are called by name, including her hometown of Clinton. Although she continued to travel after graduating in 1973, she slowly learned to treasure her past. "I've finally grown to appreciate my roots, the landscape, and the culture of the prairie," she said. Hubert also describes and generalizes the typical Midwestern personality in her book. As quoted from the first chapter of Shrink-Wrapped, "They were smack in the center of Illinois where stoicism was invented. Any Midwesterner unfortunate enough to be sitting on a chair outside the chief's office wouldn't make a peep." The story follows a psychologist as she searches for a missing child. The main character, Dr. Lou Ann Dryden, finds herself confused by the good guys and the bad guys. A clinical psychologist herself, Hubert also writes poems, short stories, travel pieces, as well as fiction. Although she has traveled throughout the world, she chose central Illinois as the backdrop to this novel. Shrink-Wrapped is set in this area because the Midwest is underrepresented in literature, she said, and also it is what I know and love. For 22 years, Hubert has made her home with her husband in Lowell, Indiana, a small town similar to Clinton. "I've never felt more at home," she said of her current residence. "It's very like my hometown in size and culture." The author has a short drive from family and friends still living in central Illinois, whom she visits often. But it is also her adventures outside of the area that helped her as a writer. "I've traveled to and lived in many places around the globe and enjoyed every single minute of those experiences," she said. "But my heart stayed here in the Midwest." The book title is Shrink Wrapped. The author is Dr. Belinda Hubert. It's a paperback. List price is $8.99. It's available on Amazon.com, Kindle.com, and locally at Clinton Hallmark Store and Lincoln Square Gallery in Clinton. And three books are highlighted in the New at the Library article. The Dark Forest by Sixin Liu, translated by Joel Martinson. This near-future trilogy is the first chance for English-speaking readers to experience this multiple award-winning phenomenon from Sixin Liu, China's most beloved science fiction author. In The Dark Forest, Earth is reeling from the revelation of a coming alien invasion in 4 centuries' time. The aliens' human collaborators may have been defeated, but the presence of the Sophons, the subatomic particles that allow Trisolaris instant access to all human information, means that Earth's defense plans are totally exposed to the enemy. Only the human mind remains a secret. This is the motivation for the Wall Facer Project, a daring plan that grants 4 men enormous resources to design secret strategies hidden through deceit and misdirection from Earth and Trisolaris alike. 3 of the Wall Facers are influential statesmen and scientists, but the 4th is a totally unknown person. Liu Ji, an unambitious Chinese astronomer and sociologist, is baffled by his new status. All he knows is that he's one Wall Facer that Trisolaris wants dead. Sixin Liu is the most prolific and popular science fiction writer in the People's Republic of China. He is an 8-time winner of the Galaxy Award and a winner of the Chinese Nebula Award. Prior to becoming a writer, he worked as an engineer in a power plant. Translator Joel Martinson is the managing editor of Danwai.org, a blog about Chinese media. Then from nonfiction, Not Fade Away, A Memoir of Senses Lost and Found, by Rebecca Alexander with Sasha Alper. Born with a rare genetic mutation called Usher Syndrome Type 3, Rebecca Alexander has been simultaneously losing both her sight and hearing since she was a child, and she was told that she would likely be completely blind and deaf by 30. Then at 18, a fall from a window left her athletic body completely shattered. In Not Fade Away, Rebecca tells her extraordinary story by turns harrowing, funny, and inspiring. She meditates on what she's lost, from the sound of a whisper to seeing a sky full of stars, and what she's found in return, an exquisite sense of intimacy with those she is closest to, a love of silence, a profound gratitude for everything she still has, and a joy in simple pleasures that most of us forget to notice. Not Fade Away is both a memoir of the senses and a unique look at the physical, psychological, and philosophical obstacles we all face, exploring the extraordinary powers of memory, love, and perseverance. It is a gripping story, an offering of hope and motivation, and an exquisite reminder to live each day to its fullest. And then finally, for the young adult category, The Troubles of Johnny Cannon by Isaiah Campbell. It's 1961 in Cullman, Alabama, and racial and political tensions are running high. Johnny's older brother, a pilot, is away on military assignment, and Johnny is now the man of the house, left to look after his difficult, disabled father. While his father spends his days secreted away in a shed out back, unwilling to discuss the radio equipment he's suddenly so preoccupied with, Johnny struggles to find his place and point of view. This debut novel offers a compelling look at 1960s espionage, Cold War paranoia, and Southern racial tensions, narrated by the singular Johnny Cannon, whose voice readers won't soon forget. And the Prairie Talk column, Gary Geisler for the Herald and Review, Sailing Across the Country with Dad. Dad will always be one of my heroes. And, of course, Dad served in the Navy during World War II, But did you know that Dad had his very own battleship? Yep, he a battleship owner. No, it was not painted gray. And no, it did not float. It didn't even bear a fancy name like the USS Nashville. In 1965, Dad bought a white Ford Country Squire station wagon. We didn't know yet about SUVs or even minivans back then, so a station wagon was a fully operable personal carrier or family hauler, if you like. And yes, this was Dad's battleship. First of all, I don't know who came up with the idea for that fake wood siding. They called it simulated wood grain trim. I think it was intended to give the car a very cosmopolitan look. Maybe add some class, like a vintage Woody. But it screamed of cheap. It did have a third row of seats, but the third row was facing out the back window, so Jeff and I would always be looking at the car or truck behind us, and we would amuse ourselves by communicating with sign language. If it was a truck, we would signal the driver to sound his horn, and if it was people in a car, we would point at each other and hold our noses like someone was stinking up the car. Real intellectual stuff. My sister would sit in the second row by herself, where she would work on her quest to read every book in the library. She is a librarian today. Dad was the driver. Mom would sit up front to give Dad instructions. Things like when to stop for lunch or to turn off the Cub game on the radio. We knew it was Dad's personal battleship because he would harken back to his Navy days when we were loading up for the trip. Dad would lash down the cargo suitcases on the roof with a rope, using only the best of sailor's knots. And when we were ready to go, Dad would announce, "Now hear this. Batten down the hatches. All hands on deck. Stand ready to shove off." And off we would go for some great summertime adventure. To Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, the Rocky Mountains, Mackinac Island, all worthy ports. Each time, Dad would entertain us with his songs he learned in the Navy. He must have cleaned them up because there was never a dirty word in his songs. "I'll take a leg from some old table. I'll take an arm from some old chair." In later years, my sister bought Dad a boatswain whistle as a memory of our trips as kids on Dad's battleship. Fast forward to today. Try as I may, when my kids and I now get ready to shove off for vacation, I can never duplicate Dad's excitement and cheerfulness. But I give it my best effort. Songs, sound effects, the works. And the kids say, "Come on, Dad, that stuff is getting old." Yes, exactly. Further news from the local Nation page, Peoria man charged in homicide. From Clinton, a Peoria man is charged with drug-induced homicide in the October 30th, 2015 death of a Clinton woman. The Clinton Police Department said Friday that Joshua Dubson, 31, formerly of Clinton, is in DeWitt County Jail in lieu of $25,000. He was arrested Thursday in Peoria by members of the U.S. Marshals Service Fugitive Task Force, according to a Clinton police statement. The charge stems from an investigation into the death of Christina Godinet, who was found unresponsive by Clinton police and first responders at the home she and Dubson shared, police said. She was pronounced dead at the scene after Dubson, who was her boyfriend, called 911 from the apartment, police said. Dubson later pleaded guilty to misdemeanor possession of drug paraphernalia, charges that related to the police investigation of the death scene. Drug-induced homicide is a Class X felony punishable by sentence of 6 to 30 years in prison. DeWitt County State's Attorney Dan Markwell said Friday that charges were filed after he and law enforcement received copies of the coroner's report. The reports included the results of toxicology tests, which Markwell declined to disclose as part of the investigation. In order to prove a drug-induced homicide, the state must show that a person possessed an illegal substance and administered it to another person, resulting in that person's death, Markwell said. Dubson is expected to be arraigned this week in DeWitt County Court. Assisting Clinton police in the investigation were Illinois State Police, Task Force 6, the DeWitt County Sheriff's Office, and the DeWitt County Coroner's Office. From the opinion page, students can't be hurt in any political fight. When the state budget stalemate is finally resolved, we must unite behind one message. Never again can we let students become collateral damage in political fights. It may sound like a cliche to say that our children are our future, but in the case of higher education, it is quite literally true. If we do not tend to the education of the next generation, we have no future. The blunt economic facts of higher education bear that out. A federal National Center for Educational Statistics study found the median earnings for young adults aged 25 to 34 with a bachelor's degree is $48,500, $18,000 more than those with a high school diploma, and more than double what those who do not graduate from high school earn. The students need the opportunity of our campuses. We need their tax dollars spreading in our local and state economies. They fuel our economic centers, providing and supporting jobs and creating opportunities for all Illinoisans. The higher education funding stalemate is much more costly than lost opportunities. Data shows high school graduates under age 25 are 3 times more likely to be unemployed than their college-educated peers, a trend that follows them throughout their lives. Taxpayers pay unemployment costs. The Congressional Budget Office conservatively puts those costs at a staggering more than $500 billion over the past 5 years. Colleges have had to adapt to the reality that graduation is a tenuous proposition. Completion rates are declining. Any interruption of the college education can doom the completion chances, particularly for lower-income working students supported by the state's Monetary Award Program grant funding. For more than 150 years, Lincoln College has focused on these students. The institution was founded to provide a college education to Central Illinois students whose parents could not send them across the country to East Coast schools. Today, we continue to serve those students and others seeking an affordable opportunity to go to college. A sustainable MAP program is vital to Lincoln College's success as we move to becoming a university with many exciting 4-year and advanced degree programs and offer a more complete educational experience. About 80% of our full-time students and 2/3 of all of our students qualify for MAP grants. MAP funding is an important safety net shoring up the connection between our educational offerings and many of our students. The MAP crisis is hitting our campus this semester as we have had to make the painful decision to cut by 40% the MAP grant funding we have to date covered for our students. We will restore the MAP grants to full funding here as soon as there is a budget resolution because we know the difficult situation this will create for many of our students and their families. We cannot minimize the impact on older students, a key part of the educational mission at Lincoln College through the successful and growing Accelerated Bridge to Education, ABE, program. These older students ABE is geared for, students taking classes while in the workforce to advance their careers, are the ones hit hardest, as the largest decline in student enrollment in a college completion survey last fall was among students aged 25 and older. We do all we can to help these adult students, but juggling family, career, and an uncertain future at school can simply be too much. Illinois cannot succeed without a well-educated, talented, motivated, and successful influx of college graduates each and every year. Most students only get one chance to go to college. Anyone who has reached adulthood knows how fleeting time and opportunity can be. Forcing students to put their education on hold while politicians do battle in Springfield isn't an opportunity delayed. It can be an opportunity denied with costly consequences for everyone in Illinois. This opinion was by David Gerlach, president of Lincoln College. Also from the opinion page by Gene Robinson, Failure of Old School Politics. Whoever wins tonight in Iowa, and whoever eventually wins the presidential nominations, one thing is already clear. Traditional politics and politicians have failed. That glaring fact is still difficult for the establishments of both parties to grasp. I mean, surely Republicans will realize they cannot possibly nominate a populist tycoon with zero experience in government who vows to round up and expel 11 million people. Of course, it will dawn on Democrats that it is inconceivable to have a self-declared socialist as their standard-bearer. Inevitably, the planets will return to their normal orbits, and everything will go back to the way it should be. Anyone thinking along these lines, I believe, is in for an unpleasant surprise. I know that not a single vote has been cast. I realize it's still probable that Democrats will eventually settle on an establishment candidate. And still possible, though pretty unlikely, that Republicans will do the same. But even if the Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders insurrections somehow fizzle, their impact will not soon fade. These unlikely messengers are showing us how ignorant many of our leaders are about the nation they purportedly serve. As individuals, Sanders and Trump are hardly cut from the same cloth. One rails against billionaires and one is a billionaire. Their supporters would probably not mix well at a cocktail party. But there's a reason these are the only two candidates who regularly fill basketball arenas with passionate, standing-room-only crowds. Both call for change that is fundamental, not cosmetic or incremental. And there are specifics on which Trump and Sanders agree. Both stridently denounce free trade agreements such as NAFTA and the new Trans-Pacific Partnership, saying they depress U.S. wages and send jobs to other countries. Establishment Democrats and Republicans, by contrast, have rarely seen a free trade pact they didn't like. Apparently, all the assurances from eminent economists that free trade is a plus for the economy offer little comfort to voters who commute past empty acres where factories once stood. Sanders supports truly universal single-payer health care, which he describes with the shorthand Medicare for All. Trump wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act, a position every Republican candidate is required to take, but also has been a consistent supporter of universal care, though he does not specify how he would bring it about. It turns out that many voters dislike big government, but need and demand the services it provides. Ideological purity does not cure disease, and everybody eventually gets sick. Trump and Sanders are both skeptical of the establishment consensus about America's role as the world's policeman. Sanders would use military force only as a last resort. Trump would let Vladimir Putin take charge of cleaning up the Syria mess if he wants to. Politicians in Washington have given us a series of long, messy wars fought almost exclusively by the sons and daughters of the working class that don't end in victory parades and somehow create as many threats as they eliminate. Trump and Sanders both show that there are huge numbers of Americans out there whose voices are not being heard, voters who are tired of half measures and unkept promises. Whatever happens between now and November, this alienation will not magically disappear. Political parties that lose touch with their constituents end up going the way of the Whigs. This has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, February 1st, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again soon.